Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind, Voyage to the Cultures of Consciousness with your host, Eric Davis. Well, you know, on this show we talk about technology and neuroscience and mysticism and shamanism and religion and media, but, you know, we haven't spent a lot of time talking about quantum physics, and I'll tell you why. I am allergic to New Age quantum physics. Now, I read those books when I was a kid, like everybody, or a budding expanded mind thinker. I read the Tao Six and the Dancing Woolly Masters, and they blew my mind. And I was very interested in Bell's Theorem, which we'll be talking about on this show. But at a certain point, I became completely frustrated and sort of fatigued by the claims made about quantum physics by sort of, you know, New Age thinkers, and mostly just because I happened to know physicists, like actual physicists. So I'd say, hey, there's this weird thing, you know, like it seems like consciousness is actually changing the nature of reality directly. And they'd say, well, it's not quite like this. You can think about it this way. And then they'd explain the way that, you know, a sort of more mainstream physicist would account for quantum weirdness. And while the weirdness is still there, its implications for our world, for our life, were a little bit curtailed compared to the sort of big New Age physics thing. And then, like, what the bleep can we know is just the final straw. That was just the last straw for me. I was like, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. So I was incredibly happy to see our guest David Kaiser's new book cross my desk, How the Hippies Saved Physics, Science, Counterculture, and the Quantum Revival. Because it does one of my favorite things to do with weirdness, which is to historicize it. How did this happen? Who were the people who thought that there was some connection between paranormal phenomena, consciousness, and quantum physics? What is the story about the philosophical implications of quantum physics, and how and where did it actually come up? And Professor Kaiser does a remarkable job in this book. It's really fun to read. He's a physicist as well as a professor of the history of science, and so it combines, like, you know, real deal knowledge with a very good sensitivity for how it is that scientific ideas actually function in the world through institutions, through publications. How do these ideas percolate? When do they trigger things? And he discusses one of the most interesting things that comes up, and we'll talk about it in more detail today, but just the way that ideas that are wrong ultimately can be incredibly useful. And therefore, there's a room for visionaries and speculative, metaphysical, even magical thinking to a degree, because it can help provide the context for further understanding. So anyway, it's a great way to understand some of this issue about the relationship of quantum physics to mysticism, to consciousness, but really looking at it in terms of the development of the science itself. But before we bring David on, I want to bring on our co-host, Maja Daou. Maja, how are you doing?
I'm good, Eric. How are you?
Pretty good. Have you didn't study any physics, right? You studied biology.
I did study physics, actually. I did biochemistry, biology, hard chemistry, and physics. And in fact, like you, I had a pretty negative reaction to a lot of the New Age quantum physics kind of thing. And my reaction to that led me to read books by physicists. Like, I mean, I've read most of the essays by Wolfgang Pauli. I've read, like, you know, Heisenberg's work. I've read, you know, a lot of stuff by all those kind of folks that were introducing those theories. Not like the math stuff. I really kind of have a brain freeze when it gets into the physics math, but theoretical physics I love. And so for me, I am most interested in how did the theoretical physicists come up with those ideas? And a lot of times, they're sort of similar to some of these hippies that, you know, are talked about in David Kaiser's book. Like a lot of these folks would get, I mean, even look at Isaac Newton, right? I mean, he got into astrology and sort of these really froofy things, and that's what led him into these bigger discoveries in science. So I'm always interested in finding out these, like, fringer outsiders that make these huge leaps into these worlds. So I'm very excited to be talking about it today.
Great. Well, let's bring David on. David, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Eric. I'm glad to be here.
This is great. So, well, since Maja was talking about the sort of original wave, I thought maybe a place to start off would be to talk about the role of these more philosophical, speculative, even kind of metaphysical questions, the role that those things played in the sort of first wave of quantum theory when people were really wrestling with this in the days of Heisenberg and Einstein and Schrodinger and all that. Because you tell a very, very interesting story about the rise and fall and rise again of, let's call it, speculative weirdness in terms of the understanding and discussion of physics. But it really starts at the beginning.
It does. That's a great point. So, you know, one thing to remember is that the very notion of a profession for something called theoretical physics is actually relatively new. It's relatively young. I mean, you could only get a job with the job title theoretical physicist, you know, just over 100 years ago, starting only over 100 years ago. It's not that it's always been a job that people grew up and wanted to apply for. And so many of the people you just mentioned who were among the founders, the creators of quantum theory in the first place, people like Niels Bohr and Albert Einstein, and Wolfgang Pauli and Werner Heisenberg, they were second, maybe third generation for this activity at all. Why I bring that up is that means they were still kind of carving out what this job should be like. You know, what is it that a theoretical physicist is supposed to do? If it's a new job, they got, you know, some sort of leeway to figure out what the job should be like. And each of them, in different ways, but each of them was really convinced in the 19-teens, 20s, and 30s, that to do the job right, they had to engage with a kind of philosophy, with trying to be philosophical, at times overtly speculative. Of course, they had to know their math, they had to calculate, but for them it was part of the same activity. You didn't just do the math and stop and philosophize. They saw it as part of one kind of one activity for this new kind of job, the theoretical physicist. And, you know, one thing to remember is that most of those folks were growing up in Central Europe. They had gone to high schools where they had studied, you know, Kantian philosophy or certain very highfalutin philosophical traditions. It made a little more sense, a little more natural for them to think about metaphysics in a kind of schooled or disciplined way. But nonetheless, they thought it was not enough to only be a mathematician, wasn't enough only to worry about the readings on dials and so on in the laboratory, that part of their job was to think philosophically.
Yeah, so then let's talk about some of the conundrum that come up that will play such a huge role in the main part of your book, which is looking at these, let's call them fringe physicists in the 1970s who are really going to push quantum weirdness about, you know, farther than you can imagine taking it. But some of the seeds of those problems and ideas are also coming up around this first wave. So what's really the important thing to keep in mind at this point?
Well, there are a couple, and I think, you know, many of your listeners might know at least the terms. They're pretty familiar today. Things like wave-particle duality, which we can talk about in a moment. It's a term that's been around for most of the 20th century. It's still beguiling, but it's been around for a while. And then things that come to be known as entanglement, or ultimately by the name of Bell's theorem, which has to do with these sort of strange connections between quantum particles, that if they've interacted at one point or had a certain kind of origin, they can retain these very strange, hard-to-understand connections or links that really continue to frustrate efforts to grapple with those sort of in words. Of course, another one was just things like Schrodinger's cat and this restriction to probabilities. Could quantum mechanics tell us how the world must always be, or were we forever restricted to just calculating likelihoods? it's likely that this would happen, or is it necessary that such a thing would happen? And that slippage from determined to probabilistic outcomes was one of these things that the greats of the 1920s and 30s, you know, always beat their heads against. It's partly why Einstein broke with quantum theory, became an outspoken critic of it till his death. Other people thought that opened up the room for sort of, you know, free will. That's where human consciousness would lie. Many, you know, Nobel laureates would say those kinds of things. In that heyday of the birthplace of quantum theory.
Well, let's just lay down particularly the issue around entanglement and Bell's theorem. Again, it's like, you know, is somebody, if you're reasonably well versed in, you know, interesting thinking, weird thinking, new age thinking, you know, you're interested in metaphysical or cosmological consequences of science, then, you know, a reasonably good reader, even if they don't have any formal training in physics, will be somewhat familiar with all of the elements that you've mentioned, to either read about it casually or actually really tried to understand it as best you can without having math, or even sometimes with math. But I think that it's the entanglement Bell's theorem thing that's really the kind of core, the hero of your story in terms of the physics problems. And since it's a little bit tricky, what, you know, do you mind putting on your physics professor hat and being like, and giving us a little bit of taste of what it was that people were talking about that at first was a very obscure thing that people just almost didn't really want to think about or didn't see the implications of. And then it becomes this very important player in quantum theory and even, you know, quantum cryptography, as you talk about at the end. So tell us about entanglement.
Sure, yeah, I'd be glad to. So the basic idea for entanglement, again, it seems very strange, is that pairs of objects, particles, say, little tiny quantum particles that had been prepared a certain way, so it's not any old pair of particles, but, you know, very, very easy to produce types of situations at this point. It's not a complete rarity anymore. These particles can go their merry way. One can shoot off at the speed of light in one direction. The other can shoot off in the opposite direction equally quickly. It can move very far away from each other very quickly. And what's amazing, it's still really just so beguiling, is that if a physicist decides to make a measurement on one of those particles, say the one that's moving off to the left, and she can choose to measure any number of properties. She has all kinds of fancy equipment in her lab. She can measure things like the polarization or something like the spin, and some basic quantum property of that particle, well-defined, easy to measure by now, nothing spooky about that. Her decision of which property to measure will affect the measurements made on the companion particle, even if that's now, you know, six galaxies away, so that there can be an instantaneous connection between the outcomes of measurements performed on these two particles, even though they stopped interacting long ago, even though it seems like no possible signal or influence could go from particle A to particle B, that this would be traveling instantaneously, which relativity seems to suggest very strongly, you shouldn't be allowed, that these particles retain what often was actually called telepathy. It was used kind of playfully. But it seems very much like they have this kind of spooky connection. Einstein himself was aware of this notion that seemed to be embedded in quantum theory, and he hated it. He called it spooky action at a distance, which was not meant to be a compliment. He hated it. He said, if that's what your theory predicts, so much the worse for your theory. But nonetheless, quantum theory seems to require, it's not an option, it's built hardwired into the equations, that these two particles, or three, or all kinds of exotic scenarios now, will behave as if they're part of one unbroken whole, even though the parts might be physically quite separated and isolated in space. And that's where you start, you know, people's heads start to hurt. It is very hard to come to grips with that in kind of ordinary language.
Yeah, you know, go ahead, Masha.
I was just going to say, they also kind of found something similar with photon research, right? Like Max Planck, a lot of the work he did was under the assumption that actually there weren't separate photons, that they were all part of a cohesive whole. So it was kind of interesting that was happening, you know, I always like to compare entanglement with some of Max Planck's photon stuff, where he had the idea that like every piece of light you see isn't like an individual photon, but it's all part of this giant thing, and that's how non-locality and entanglement can kind of operate.
Well, I think they're distinct. They're both sides of this sort of wonderful quantum weirdness. You're right. So the notion that I think you're getting at is often now called Bose-Einstein condensation, another thing that was hypothesized for most of the 20th century and only produced physically in laboratories really recently, like in the 1990s. But again, where you can have lots and lots of these particles acting, it's almost like the Borg, if you like, in Star Trek. They can act as part of a coherent whole, and so the separation between sort of parts and wholes can break down or can be can get fuzzy. That's absolutely right. It turns out that's a distinct notion than entanglement, but it's similar in the sense that the quantum states can behave in all kinds of ways that, you know, sort of baseballs and ping pong balls and stuff we're familiar with at our own human scale, they simply don't do that. So they're both examples of this sort of quantum parts and wholes can get pretty fuzzy.
Well, what I wanted to ask about and to again frame one of the things that's marvelous about your book is that you're coming to this not only as a physicist, but as someone interested in the history and in the sociology of science. And your earlier books are more, I think fair to say, academic books about the construction of physics and scientific institutions and how scientific ideas and procedures move from one group of people to another group and what their networks are like. And so it's a very historical and material way of sociological way of understanding how science is done. And from the outside, it's a really wonderful way, because a lot of times, you know, you're interested in these ideas and you read someone's account and then you read somebody else's account and they're different and you're like, I can't really get a map for this. But by understanding the history and the sociology of the science, it's like, okay, that you get a better sense for how it actually happens. And the big story that you told that I just had never thought about was the way that, okay, we have all these, profound humanist intellectuals of Europe who are also physicists and scientists, but also humanists and interested in philosophy and poetry, and they have this kind of, you know, wonderfully rich period that's so exciting. And then it's like, it just goes away. And you tell this really wonderful story about how something like Bell's, or like quantum entanglement, which seems like absolutely key to figuring out the nature of reality, becomes sort of like something to ignore for 20 odd years, if not longer. So talk about that post-war sort of period and how much it changed what physics meant and what kinds of questions were legitimate and not legitimate.
Sure. Yeah. No. You're right. That really is a very strong interest of mine in this book and in lots of other writing that I've been doing. It's another way of getting at this question: what counts as quote unquote real physics? And that's a moving target over time. And that's part of what I really enjoy looking back, is that things we take for granted today can be of quite recent, you know, vintage. They might have looked exactly opposite, you know, not all that long ago. And so there, we do find these kind of oscillations in what the community, let's say the physics community, you could take for granted. And what they take for granted, they go, at a given moment, they're going to kind of hardwire into, or try to at least, into the next generation. That's what training is all about. So how do they rewrite the textbooks? How do they change the exams for the next, you know, batch of students? So it really has consequence, but also something that we can sort of track over time, because it leaves all these marks, you know. And so just as you were saying, there's a tremendous sea change. Many, you know, scientists and historians and philosophers have looked at this for a while now. A tremendous sea change in the day-to-day activity of doing physics after World War II, or sort of during and after World War II. There was, as you mentioned, the kind of continental tradition through the certainly mid to late 30s. Of course, that starts coming under tremendous strain with the rise of fascism in Europe. Lots of people have to leave, often under very difficult circumstances, so that community is busted apart for all kinds of reasons. And at the same time, you have the rise of these incredibly kind of important, timely defense projects like radar, you know, based largely at MIT, like the atomic bomb project, like dozens and dozens, in fact, of similar kind of weapons or national security projects that were based on physics, on electrical engineering, on all kinds of physical sciences type approaches. And so many of these folks were refugees from, you know, fleeing Hitler. They were tremendously worried about what might happen if Germany had gotten their hands on some of these new types of weapons. They threw themselves into weapons research with a kind of earnestness. It looked like, you know, the fate of the free world depended on it. And in the process, there was a kind of change in orientation, that you're not going to make these new gadgets on a very, very harsh, quick time scale, if you're also, it was felt at least, if you're also sitting around kind of philosophizing about what it all means. If you're worrying about keeping a dream diary, as Wolfgang Pauli did, to discuss, you know, the collective unconscious with Carl Jung, which is what Pauli did until that time. So there's a different mode of work, right? There's a different sense of what the priorities are about with whom you interact, military planners, politicians, engineers of all kinds. And so the work becomes not degraded, but different, right? It's a different type of work that now gets done as physics. It's not bad, right? It's not like it becomes dumbed down physics, but it's a different choice in priorities. And coming out of World War II, especially in the United States, but many other places too, there's a kind of pragmatism or a kind of instrumentalism that becomes much more, that seems much more obvious as the way forward. This is the birth of the era when things like the transistor are invented by very, very, you know, excellent Nobel Prize winning physicists. That's not sort of, you know, mousetrap engineering. That's real hard physics. It's not, you know, daydreaming about the big metaphysical questions. It's a different mode, right? And as I argue in the book I've written about elsewhere, I think another part that kind of drives that shift home is this unbelievable, unprecedented expansion in the numbers of people clamoring to become physicists. The enrollments grow exponentially after the war, faster than every other field in terms of rates of growth. Physics became an absolute, an amazing kind of golden era coming out of World War II, mostly in the United States, where the number of PhD holders was doubling every sort of 3 years, every 6 years. It was just explosive growth. And so one of the things that I've been trying to understand or trying to track is how do you change the teaching of physics, and I mean sort of graduate level PhD student physics, if you're teaching, you know, auditoria of 100 students at a time and not seminars of a dozen. And that also, I suggest, kind of reinforced this turn to a kind of pragmatism. Again, it's not dumbing down. The generation of physicists who are coming up in the 40s, 50s, 60s could do calculations that some of the founders couldn't even have dreamed of. There's an amazing accumulation of skill there, but it's a choice. It's a kind of road not taken. They're getting drilled in a kind of problem set culture to do very, very hard calculations, which many of them do exceedingly well. But what they're not doing is also getting asked to write, say, long, verbose essay questions about, you know, like the meaning of life and what these paradoxes of quantum theory imply for, you know, the meaning of objectivity, which is what indeed had been an expected part of training physicists before World War II in many places, including the U.S. So it's one of these forks in the road, and what counts as sort of real physics, how that gets reinscribed in teaching, in textbooks and exams, in the journals, in editorial policies. And so we have this period coming out of World War II, right into sort of the late 60s, early 70s, where, you know, a different kind of standard, a different set of assumptions about what theoretical physics should be all about, really held sway. It was pushing questions like the philosophical foundations or these weird conundra that had so bothered the people like Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg. It pushed those questions largely to the side. The questions weren't solved; they were just kind of shelved. And some other, you know, really quite wonderful but different style results were pursued instead.
Well, this is a wonderful setup to the countercultural hippie freak physicist that we're going to get into, but it's also a good time for us to take a break. So we're going to take a short break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind. We're talking to David Kaiser, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Listening to the Progressive Radio Network, a station that doesn't rest until you're informed. Thanks for listening.
Hello! This is Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host of Animal Magnet Pet Radio. You can listen live to me every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern for the best pet radio in America, Canada, and beyond. Hard-hitting pet issues, animal news, training tips, tricks, games, and quirky pet trivia, plus the A-list pet guests each week. Or listen anytime to past shows at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Listen to this show so you can be good to your animals.
Most incisive analysis on the state of our planet from a black left perspective, join me, Glenn Ford, and my colleague Nellie Bailey at Black Agenda Radio, right here on the Progressive Radio Network. We bring you the full scope of reality as we and our interlocutors see it every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Black Agenda Radio, the place to get oriented to the black left worldview on the Progressive Radio Network.
Every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, join the founders of the Godspeed Institute for Spiritual Learning, Carol and Michael Hallenbeck, for Godspeed, an enlightening and informative journey into the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Through conversations with experts worldwide, this weekly live call-in program is an on-air classroom aimed at helping listeners gain exposure to and insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world. Every Sunday, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Houston, we have a problem.
Christiane Brown. In today's 24-hour news cycle, most people get about a minute of real truth. Not on the Solution Zone. Every week, I bring in America's best-known activists, bloggers, authors, and politicians to uncover the hidden issues that help separate the truth from the spin.
The Solution Zone with Christiane Brown, every Wednesday at 3 on Progressive Radio Network.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis. We're talking with David Kaiser, who wrote a work called How the Hippies Saved Physics. Pretty great. David, before the break, you were talking about that kind of difference of innovation, how sometimes it can be driven just by pure pragmatism, and then otherwise it can be kind of inspired by daydreams. And this is something that's fascinating to me, that kind of inception of discovery and what is the combination that unlocks those keys to discovery. And I mean, for me, I love hearing stories about, like, you know, the discovery of DNA with Crick and Watson and how there was kind of drugs involved and, you know, they had a lot of crazy dreams and then later went on to read about UFOs and, like, how that was tied in, or, like, Cary Mullis, who the surfer who discovers the polymerase chain reaction and believes in astrology, or, you know, going back. And you had talked about that kind of, that sometimes it's just people that do the hard physics, the hard science. And, I mean, I'd read this little piece called The Creative Moment that talked about, you know, some of the competition with physicists in World War II, how they kind of made them fight to try to discover things that would lead to, like, you know, the atomic bomb and stuff like that, and the Manhattan Project and things like that, that were all done hard science style. And so I was just curious if, in your experience, do you see a difference between that kind of daydreamy discovery that, like, the hippies might have done and the direction of science it might take as compared to some of the more pragmatic discoveries that get kind of figured out, the divorce from the philosophy, from the religion, from the daydreams? Like, is there kind of a difference that you've discerned?
I think so. And again, I think ultimately the field needs a kind of balance. You know, I think it needs all kinds of approaches. And I think, I mean, if I were to editorialize now, I think physics as a whole has a much, we might say, you know, healthier portfolio now of many different types of research, of styles, of questions that are deemed legitimate than in previous times. And again, that's a kind of, you know, pendulum that can swing in one direction or the other. And so, And what really drew me to the story about the people I write about in the book was that they kind of embodied that combination. They weren't just daydreaming. They certainly were daydreaming. And they were very creative and open-minded and open to all kinds of new experiences and weird things. They were in the San Francisco area in the early 70s, this kind of, you know, hippie explosion and counterculture new age scene. And they were curious about that. But at the same time, they had done PhDs at some of the nation's finest, most elite physics departments. I mean, they were incredibly well-trained. And they had that combination that I think was really so important, that they could ask the kind of out-of-left-field questions. They were kind of outside the mainstream by the time they were doing the work that I describe, largely because of bigger changes in the country and in the physics profession and the job market and all that kind of stuff. So they were carving out a new way to do their work, open to these new things like, you know, mind reading possibilities and all the rest. But they were able to attack those questions with incredibly careful, you know, well trained, disciplined, hard calculating skills. So they had that kind of mixture, you know. And I think if you look around, I mean, jumping forward in time today, you know, if you go to any physics department in the world, that where you have people doing cosmology and astrophysics, you know, you're gonna hear some pretty weird, far out, wonderful, trippy ideas there too, being talked about by, you know, incredibly smart, driven, you know, hardworking, well-trained people. So I think there's a way in which the kinds of big, far-out questions have a kind of toehold again. But it took a while for that to sort of come back into the mainstream.
Well, and it's more than just people asking interesting, you know, provocative, speculative questions that have that sort of cosmic bent to them. But it's actual, quote-unquote real breakthroughs on the level of technology and, you know, business practices, and particularly, you know, you talk about quantum cryptography and this sort of long route through this hippie weirdness to recognizing the possibilities in a kind of interesting way, because it's really more about a failure of a certain vision than it is about the successful speculations of some of the, you know, these wild thinkers, particularly, you know, Nick Herbert and Jack Sarfati and these other kind of characters. But that is just a wonderful, wonderful story and an interesting argument, too, about how science works, how the visions of science can be productive, even if they're not exactly right on the mark. So talk about that arc of your tale, how exactly, what it was that these freaks were doing conceptually and sending out ideas that helped set in motion things that would affect, you know, how billion-dollar companies make transactions electronically now.
Sure, yeah. So it is a kind of ironic or unexpected, you know, outcome. So like you mentioned, a bunch of folks that I wrote about, they were members of this little informal kind of discussion group. They called themselves the Fundamental Physics Group. They were mostly unemployed or underemployed, at least at the time. These are folks, like I mentioned, who had finished their PhDs in physics from very, very, you know, elite programs, just as the kind of bottom fell out of the physics job market. And they, through sort of no fault of their own, they, like 1,000 other people at the time or more, simply couldn't get jobs in a kind of traditional trajectory that they might have expected. If you go to grad school, you get a job in physics at a university or government lab, industrial lab. That got very, very rapidly upturned. It was basically the popping, the bursting of a speculative bubble, like the housing market bubble. It just went down to nowhere in no time at all. So these folks made their way to Berkeley, California, and they had these big kind of speculative metaphysical questions that had attracted them to physics in the first place. They went through their really hard training where they found none of those questions, you know, attacked in their studies. They've been pushed aside. And they figured, well, now, you know, what's to lose? They had time on their hands. And they had these questions that were still urgent. On top of that, there were what looked like new reasons to ask about things like the foundations of quantum theory right in their backyard. So the Israeli performer, he had once been a stage magician, Uri Geller, was claiming psychic abilities, mind reading, psychokinesis, and all these weird, cool things. And that was being studied at a spin-off defense contractor laboratory that had once been affiliated with Stanford University, meaning, you know, in the Bay Area. And that was getting front page coverage in the mainstream newspapers at the time in San Francisco. And a bunch of these physicists who were having these kind of, you know, discussion sessions about things like Bell's theorem, what is quantum theory telling us about the universe, they wondered if maybe someone like Geller or some of the other self-proclaimed, you know, psychics or mind readers, maybe they really could do it, because maybe the quantum particles in their brain were, you know, tangled up or entangled with the particles in someone else's brain. They knew there should be these instantaneous connections. You know, is it so far-fetched, right, to wonder if questions like at the very foundations of quantum theory might really play a role? So they had this extra input, right, this sort of very strange local, you know, what can I say, kind of occult stuff going on right in their backyard. And that was an added push. They had time on their hands. They were well-trained. They wanted to know what quantum theory was telling us about the universe. And they had these kind of impetus. And so they became very, like I say, very playful, very avant-garde. They sort of made up, some of them made up kind of fun personalities for themselves. They wrote, you know, a physics opera to perform in the parks in the Berkeley area. They wanted to bring the wonderful, weird, strange ideas of quantum theory to sort of the public. They taught some courses at, you know, community college, the extension school levels. They really wanted to bring this stuff to the people. And they also wanted to see how far it would go. What were the real implications, right? Where did entanglement break down? What might it be telling us that we've overlooked so far? And well, so they were, you know, like I said, they were open, they were curious. Some of them were skeptical but still wanted to know. Others kind of were pretty convinced this must be a real thing and there's a new age dawning. So they have all this, it's this weird mix. It's an alchemy of really good physics training, very particular kind of local cultural excitement and stuff in the news. And they just push. They push where people otherwise were not kind of exploring.
Can you talk a little bit about how that kind of tied into the inception of like what Eric and I were talking about that we hate at the beginning of the show, how that set into like what the bleep do we know? Like, it's so, to me, it's so awesome that they were trying to make it accessible, because I mean, physics is literally one of those things that's kept away from the majority of people, almost like, I mean, the Bible was by the Catholic Church. I mean, it's so anti-invasive towards popular culture, and that really kind of kicked it into pop culture. What were some of the like kind of things that happened there that led to the kind of derailment of it into entanglement getting usurped?
Well, you're right. You know, one of the things that this group did is they were so, you know, unbelievably enthusiastic about this quest, right, about trying to really grapple with quantum theory in ways that their teachers really hadn't been doing, at least in their formal training. And yet it was still a time when the, you know, leading physics journals in the world, especially the United States, had set the bar very, very high for articles on the sort of philosophy or foundations of quantum theory, so high that people we now know as absolute world leaders in the topic couldn't get their articles published, like John Bell, whose Bell's theorem we've been describing. Literally, he had to get some of his articles shunted into like little hand-typed mimeograph newsletters. And then when the field came back, the topic came back to some kind of legitimacy, people were embarrassed and they republished his papers in regular journals. That's how strong the bar had been set, how high it had been set. And so what members of this Berkeley group did was very creative. They did a kind of end run around the physicists' usual communication approaches. On the one hand, they had their own kind of underground, you know, kind of counterculture mimeograph network that would get their papers, their sort of unpublished preprints, into all kinds of people's hands, physicists, non-physicists, UFO enthusiasts, it's like the whole you know, set, psychedelic drug enthusiasts, everything. We're getting their papers, and then on the other hand, they broke into the sort of massively successful commercial book publishing world. Some of them did, and that's where books like The Tao of Physics, and then later The Dancing Wu Li Masters, and others that then followed in the wake of those books, they became award-winning, like National Book Award or American Book Award-winning, runaway bestsellers, tremendous commercial success, and that's because these guys were doing a kind of going around the usual peer-reviewed journals. They were doing underground hand-typed mimeograph, and then they were doing this explosively successful popular book publishing as well.
So they're kind of like physics genesters.
Yeah.
They're making zines.
Well, how do you look at that now in terms of publication? How has the internet, for example, opened up a space maybe between kind of, you know, aggressively underground or sort of insider, you know, hand-printed kind of world of the zine of the 70s kind of underground publication or versus, you know, conventional publication organs with their inherited political frameworks. How are things changing now in terms of the internet and how it's playing, how it's creating different kinds of spaces for physics discourse that maybe is more unusual than what you'd find in Nature or the major physics journals?
Sure. Yeah, I think, again, like all your listeners would know, I mean, the internet has spawned, you know, a seemingly endless variety of possibilities. And you find this huge spectrum, sort of gradations of people who had a little physics training in college, who are commenting on sort of wikis, right through, you know, full professors at the leading departments who have their own blogs and everything in between, you know, and who comments on whom is actually kind of interesting, right? And so one of the things that the group that I write about was doing sort of the old-fashioned way in the 70s was something we might now very naturally see as a kind of listserv or by now a kind of wiki, you know, user group. They were doing it, you know, by hand-cranked Xerox machine and postage stamp, so it was slower to get to people's hands. But it was really a kind of, you know, like a Usenet thing. Just the technology of circulation was different, but the idea behind it was actually pretty similar. Some of them were kind of born bloggers, you know, decades before there was an internet, in the way they kind of share thoughts and so on. And they're, you know, incredibly active today on email plus all kinds of other social media type, communication outlets. And on the other hand, even so-called mainstream physics has been changing too. And again, many readers will probably know there's a single kind of centralized preprint server for basically all fields of physics now, where people, professional physicists, send their papers before peer review. And they get logged into this kind of centralized computer. Their time stamps down to the microseconds, so everyone knows to settle priority disputes, when was their paper received and all that. And it's completely free, you know. There are relatively minor hurdles now compared to when it first started in the early 90s to who can post. They're making it a little bit harder, and maybe appropriately so, so that it's really trying to capture sort of working papers by professional physicists. But they're downloadable, they're readable for free instantly by anyone anywhere, and lots and lots of people, in fact, still can post. And that also does a kind of end run around the old-style journals. These are not peer-reviewed. The journals still exist, but cynically, I often think mostly for credentialing, not really for spreading knowledge or information, because that free archive, that free preprint server is doing the great majority of that work. And so you start to say, is that really so different, or what does that imply about the gatekeepers to knowledge and all that? It's, you know, that also is evolving, and it's not the same now as it was in the 70s. And on the other hand, even further, you know, in terms of kind of formality, you see lots and lots of very, very successful, kind of lauded physicists who will write popular books now and not get their, you know, their colleagues won't turn their noses up now. That's seen as a legitimate thing to reach out to the public, explain their excitement. So I think you see lots of people who have adopted many kind of communication possibilities that really weren't so familiar or so common as recently as the 1970s or 80s.
Well, I wanted to ask you a personal question about how you deal with this material, because my sense is dealing with people I know who work in physics, especially in the wake of what the bleep and then the sort of whole cavalcade of new age physics, is that there's a real sense of, like, you know, holding the line, like, look, we're not gonna go there. And you, your book reflects a very balanced way of dealing with the full range of ideas and practices that have been associated with physics, and you don't seem to have any desire for the sort of, you know, snarky reminder of the absurdity or the reinscription of the authority of your physics degree or your position in an institution. And I'm kind of curious how you got there and how you sense that position as being different from maybe some of the other physics colleagues you deal with or other people you deal with in the field. I mean, you seem to have really kind of developed that openness to just paying attention to how things percolate rather than judging them or reminding the reader that this is, of course, foolish or whatever.
Sure, yeah. I mean, one of the things I really was very, I was really striving for, quite frankly, in the book as I was working on it, was indeed to have a kind of, not just balance, but a kind of respect for the people involved on all the various sides. I mean, I talk about a lot of people who said mean things to each other and were, you know, nasty on all sides, but it's not my job necessarily to go in and judge them. I want to say, how do these actions and debates and really passionate, heartfelt, you know, activities, how do they tell us what it means to do physics and how physics itself is sort of the moving target here, like I said before. That's what, you know, that's what really sort of excites me, is say things we take for granted today, we know they're going to fall apart tomorrow. Even our, you know, that's the way that science goes, and isn't that a good thing? How horrible if we got the last answer and science were done. What would that mean, right? So I guess what I mean to say is that there's a sense in which physics, you know, in the 1920s and 30s, like we said, had all kinds of, you know, people could say things with a straight face and put them in their textbooks, really take it very seriously, that only a decade or two later would look horribly out of fashion and people would turn up their noses. And then, you know, look, and then that style of physics, you know, doesn't last forever either. And so, so I think that's part of another part of it, again, just personally, is, you know, my own physics research is in early universe cosmology, and I mean, it's an incredibly exciting field. I love it, and there are, you know, thousands of people around the world just giving it everything they've got, and it's an amazing, exciting time for the field. But let's face it, we're talking about some pretty crazy fun stuff, right? And if we can't have a kind of sense of, balance about that, I mean, people are saying some things that, you know, taken out of context, or maybe, you know, as we'll know 3 years from now, are just blatantly preposterous, and yet they're not saying it to be dumb, they're saying it because they're pushing on ideas. They have the integrity to follow those ideas, and the ideas can lead in weird places. And that's just as true about quantum theory as it is about the Big Bang or, you know, inflation, all these things. So I guess, you know, the historians, I think, always have a kind of built-in ego buster, right? Because all the things we take for granted today are going to look foolish, you know, sometime later. And just as we look back in the past and say, how could they possibly have thought that before? That's how things go. And even from my view and where I sit in physics, you know, it's a part of what I find so fun about it is that it is so outlandish. I mean, it's not that we're making it all up. There are really good reasons. We test things as best we can, but come on, you know, extra dimensions and infinity of worlds. I mean, it gets pretty quickly into kind of la-la land, and that's part of the appeal to me as well.
Well, you know, that you dangled a marvelous piece of bait, and even though we have less than 10 minutes left on the show, I'm curious, especially given all the weird and wacky ideas from the 70s that you were absorbing for this book, ideas about, you know, telepathy and paranormal forces and multiple dimensions and psychedelic realities and all that. What are some things in the early history of the universe that most have struck you most recently, whether your own ideas or ideas of colleagues that have really gotten you like, wow, that's really bizarre, but it also makes a certain sense?
Well, you know, there are a bunch, and again, many of your listeners might already know about these, partly from, you know, physicists' blogs or their popular books. Again, these ideas are getting out there in all kinds of ways now. But, you know, there's a lot of excitement about in quantum cosmology about, you know, a possible multiverse, which is to say our entire universe that we can see, even beyond what we can see, might just be, you know, like one grain in the sand of the beach. There could be an infinitude of comparable universes that are out of contact with each other, but popping into existence all the time with their own special kind of parameters or basically their own separate laws of physics, the way they manifest. I mean, that's on the one hand, a very old idea for science fiction from generations and generations, but now some very serious people are led to take that seriously. They're pushing hard on the implications of otherwise, you know, very kind of reasonable, well-tested elements of their equations. They're pushing. Where does it break down? What else might it imply? So I think the multiverse, the so-called string landscape, these ideas are, they might well look like a preposterous, silly dead end 10 years from now, but they're not being pursued. You know, okay, there's good reasons to think about them now, even if they're not going to necessarily hold up forever, and that's okay. You know, so I think a lot of stuff about sort of string theory and what it might imply about extra dimensions and how much more to our universe is there than what we could even possibly probe? You know, that's great. That's fun to think about and to really push hard on.
So, how much farther do you think the quantum cryptography, the sort of development that spills out of some of this interest in Bell's theorem in the 70s. Are we just seeing the beginning of real practical applications of quantum weirdness in that domain? I mean, I know we've already been taking advantage of certain quantum effects for decades in our technology, but in terms of sort of a new and weirder world opening up, we hear about quantum computing, et cetera, et cetera. What is your sense about how this is going to change our actual practical technological reality?
I do think so. Again, this is not the field I work in directly in physics, but from my understanding, from working on the book, from talking with friends and colleagues who really are the experts on that right up to the minute, you know, it's an amazing flourishing field now. That's part of what was so interesting to me to try to tackle this book. It's something that is now clearly at the cutting edge, attracting some of our brightest students, getting great, you know, generous funding, government funding, private funding, and so on. Whole new degree programs popping up in this specialty. It's the real deal, you know, and rightly so. I mean, I think what these folks can do is simply inspiring. It's amazing. And to think that only, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, people who asked very similar questions were seen as, you know, crackpot crazy people on the margins who couldn't get a job. That's a short amount of time for that kind of reversal, you know. And so I do think, you know, certainly things like quantum computing can be overhyped like anything, but it's not based on nothing. I mean, there are incredibly smart, dedicated people doing amazing things. They're building actual physical quantum computers that are nowhere near the capacity of, you know, your or my laptop yet, but it's the proof of principle. You know, it's not just dreams on a blackboard. People can make, you know, genuine prototypes. I get tours of folks' labs all the time when I visit other universities. MIT is a huge group of people in many departments pushing on it, a great frontier. And, you know, quantum encryption is real. I mean, people have used it already for bank transfers, for electronic voting. I mean, there have been real-world demos and not just thought experiments now for the better part of a decade, and they're just getting better, you know. So, I think it is it's a very exciting time for that area. And all the more, therefore, you know, amazing for me to look back and see just how rapidly that new thing could grow up and become and come to the kind of cutting edge.
Well, that's also what fascinates me is how it can just take one crackpot idea, you know, like you said, and then suddenly it's an entirely different world that we operate in, because that crackpot idea was developed into something that it could actually be, like a quantum computer. You know, that's what's magical about it.
Yeah, and I mean, I should say, you know, I try to make it clear in the book as well that it was a bunch of, you know, very well trained, you know, kind of open-minded, curious folks in Berkeley, the group that I write about. But crucially, they were in contact with all kinds of, we might say, more traditional physicists who were in university departments or government labs. And it was that combination, that constant back and forth, like a game of cat and mouse. You know, well, you found the loophole in my argument that time, but what about this? And it's that constant, very, very intelligent but also playful back and forth that really did, I think, spur a lot of progress.
And then just to say one more point, that also that it's incredibly valuable to come up with visionary ideas that are wrong sometimes, because they're right enough that they cause people to figure out why they don't quite work, and then in finding out why they don't quite work, some other world is opened up. So again, from the historian's perspective, it becomes really hard to sort of be part of that policing force that one senses in a lot of disciplines, not just in the sciences, where there's certain ideas, you know, don't go there, don't head in that direction, that's going to be dangerous, because people who can go in there with clarity and intelligence, but also kind of imaginative power, can really make things that down the pike make a huge bit of difference.
They absolutely can. I mean, a phrase I often go back to is productive mistakes. I mean, you know, the number of papers published in physics every year is still growing, you know, at a fast clip. How many of those are going to look right or just relevant, you know, 3 years from now? A pretty small fraction. And that doesn't mean that we're all boneheads. It's just that's how science works, right? And so it's trivial to make lots of things that will become irrelevant or indeed mistaken. But how many of those mistakes will, like you say, will trigger much deeper insights? That the work of debunking or finding loopholes or really pressing on that hard nugget can open up whole new vistas. And those are very exciting. They push a whole field forward.
Well, David, thanks again for being on the show. Again, I really encourage our listeners to read How the Hippies Save Physics. It's not just a great story. It doesn't just tell you more about physics, but it's a wonderful way, an accessible way to understand how science works, how physics actually works as a social phenomenon, as part of our society, which is a really helpful way to approach these crazy, exciting ideas. So good luck with your stuff, and thanks for being on the show, David.
Well, thanks so much, Eric. I appreciate it.
All right, from me and Maja, keep your minds open.